Hello and welcome to the Nourish, Balance, Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly and today I'm joined by Kyle Kingsbury. Hi, Kyle.
How you doing, Chris?
I'm good. I'm slightly intimidated. People were asking for strength-based athletes to be on the podcast and I didn't just get any strength-based athlete. I got a flipping former UFC fighter. How cool is that? I'm excited.
Yep, retired from getting punched in the face, but not retired from the athletics, that's for sure.
I'm slightly intimidated by you, even though you're on the other side of a Skype connection. I think we better start by you telling us about your physical dimensions. How big are you?
Well, let's see. I'm right now, the height hasn't changed, so 6'3.5", and I'm somewhere floating in between 230 and 235, depending how ketogenic I am and how much carb backloading I've been doing.
Ooh, and then so tell me about, what's your collar size? I almost think that's one that's really scary.
Man, you know what? I haven't measured my neck in a long time, but I think when I get fitted, it's, I don't know, it's somewhere in that 18 to 19 range. I mean, yeah, most of my shirts, if I get the 20 inch neck and it fits nice, then it's a fat guy suit underneath that. So I try to get something that fits my waist nice, and then I just use the tie to kind of snug it up and get the collar to work.
Maybe I should get you to send me some pictures that I can put in the show notes. I know we were just talking about this before, that it's difficult as a UFC fighter. You don't get that many photos, but I'm sure you can dig up something that I can put in the show notes so that people can see you, because you are a striking human being, to say the very least.
Yeah, most definitely. I'll send you over some photos.
So tell me what it was like being a UFC fighter. How did you get into that?
Well, you know, I played football my whole life since I was 10 years old, and I finished up at university, as you UK folks like to say, at Arizona State University. I played Division I football there, and I wasn't good enough to play professional football. You know, like anything, I still had the itch and wanted to push myself, so I started training in mixed martial arts. And it really wasn't long after that before the guy who I was training with, he owned the gym. He also owned a small fight promotion out in Arizona. And he just said, hey, you know, you're big, you can fight heavyweight. Why don't you just get in there and get your feet wet? If you like it, you can continue. And if you don't like it, you never have to do it again. And so my first two fights, I won in under 30 seconds. And I was pretty hooked, you know, from then on. So I started training and everything kind of snowballed. I rose up pretty quickly in you know, the smaller organizations, and then made it onto the Ultimate Fighter season 8. And that was my foot in the door for the UFC. Fought for 6 years there and then retired in 2014.
That's unbelievable. How did it, are you just one of the, you're just dangerous, aren't you? You're just, had always been dangerous. Like, how do you, had you never had any history of, you didn't do kung fu or wrestling or something, like you just literally start.
Yeah, I wrestled in high school and junior high, and I fought a lot growing up. So, you know, I wasn't a stranger to that type of interaction, but it is different when you're talking about fighting somebody out of you know, anger and in the moment versus a trained guy who's you know, doing some background research on you, figuring out what you're good at, your strengths and weaknesses, and you really have no problems with the guy, but you're doing it for money and to try to work your way up to an eventual title shot. You know, all those things play into it, but it was a whole different avenue. I wasn't sure if I was going to like it, but I can honestly say the first time you knock someone out, that's one of the most addictive feelings you can have as a human being. I mean, it truly is. There's no other drug like it. The adrenaline rush you get from that is quite phenomenal. And that's really what hooked me into it initially.
Even though I'm a skinny mountain biker, I can sort of relate to it, because I used to do kung fu and kickboxing when I was younger. I used to do a lot of bench press and a lot of strength training and do all that. And I eventually bowed out of it because I keep getting my head kicked in. You know, you would spar with kids that would come into the class for the first time, and I just was getting too many injuries. I just couldn't cope with it anymore. You know, it was so difficult. Do you find that? Is it like when someone spars with you or did spar with you, that they would just be, you know, oh, well, this is Kyle Kingsbury and he's like invincible, therefore I have to put in 110%, and they would almost just go in too hard and someone would get hurt?
You know, it's not so much with the younger guys, but where I was training actually at American Kickboxing Academy in San Jose, you know, we had the heavyweight champ Cain Velasquez there. He wrestled at Arizona State when I was playing football. Luke Rockhold's the current middleweight champion. Daniel Cormier, the current light heavyweight champion. These are all guys that I was training with the majority of my career. So to put it, you know, lightly, I was going against guys who were much better than me on a regular basis, and that made me better. But it definitely took its toll. I mean, a lot of guys get hurt in the sport. due to overtraining and really just running themselves down and not putting an emphasis on recovery and rest. And I certainly fell into that group as well. But yeah, you know, that's, you get to a point where is the juice worth the squeeze, you know, because I feel fine now and I feel like I have my whereabouts, you know, but there, you know, I've had my face busted twice. I've had two orbital fractures on my left eye. I've had my left eyebrow smashed in a fight. So to say that if somebody's hitting me hard enough to break bones in my face, to act like that's not going to take its toll long term, I'm just kidding myself, you know, and really that's kind of what one of the biggest factors in my decision to retire was, just, you know, weighing out, is this worth it? Is this, is the juice worth the squeeze long term in terms of brain health and cognitive health? And with everything I've learned with nutrition and longevity and health and wellness, it was time to pull the plug.
Tell me about your style of martial arts. So you talked about kickboxing, and I'm slightly familiar with that. And I don't remember being taught anything to do with wrestling. Like, we never did any groundwork or anything like that. So how would you describe your style?
Well, I started off in wrestling in high school and junior high just to be better at football. And then when I finished football and got into mixed martial arts, I still had some wrestling knowledge, but nothing compared to the guys who fight in the UFC now. I mean, a lot of them are collegiate level or above. So really that ended up being a hindrance of mine long term. You know, like I said, my first two fights I won in under 30 seconds. Those were both by knees to the body. So I had this just a natural talent for Muay Thai, which is a form of kickboxing in Thailand. And I actually spent some time out in Phuket at Tiger Muay Thai. And I just really, I gravitated towards that. It was something that I always enjoyed, just adding new weapons, you know, knees, elbows, in addition to really powerful kicks, and being able to use my range, you know, being a taller fighter, push kicks and teeps and things like that from Muay Thai were really effective weapons for me. So I always enjoyed that. And then the first time you get big brothered by somebody who takes you down and just lays on top of you and you feel manhandled in front of 20,000 people and however many people that are watching on pay-per-view, that really gives you an appreciation for the ground game. So after I lost to Stefan Bonner here in San Jose in front of my home crowd, that really put an emphasis on wanting to be better in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and facilitated, you know, my growth and my love for that sport in the ground game, which is really my focus now.
You still are involved with fighting, but not competitively. And that's your style, is Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu now.
Yeah, I compete in Jiu-Jitsu just for fun because I think it's good to put yourself, you know, in a situation where you're uncomfortable. It's humbling. You know, you can lose to a smaller guy in jiu-jitsu and that's deeply humbling, but there's that challenge that I seek mentally, you know, of having to calm my nerves and to focus and to find stillness inside. And that's something I get from martial arts without getting my face patched in. So it's something I continue to do. And my father still competes in jiu-jitsu. He's 64 years old.
Oh, wow.
So it's something you can do for a very long time. You know, they call it the gentle art. And I think as long as you do it right and you're not afraid to tap, you know, when you're putting a submission, then you really can have a long career in it.
This is starting to interest me because I've interviewed a couple of people who I respect a lot that are really into this. So one is James Wilson, who's a strength training coach that specializes in mountain bikers. And he, I would describe him, you know, what he teaches is very similar to what Dan John teaches, who you've probably heard of.
I love Dan John. Easy Strength is one of my absolute favorite books. It's something I wish I it's so much that I learned now post fight career that I'm like, damn it, I wish I had this in my fight career because it makes so much sense.
Welcome to my world. Like every single book I read, I'm like, God damn, like Mark Sisson's Primal Endurance book. I'm going to
interview. Yes, completely agree.
I'm like, are you kidding me? Like I could have read this 15 years ago and not had any of these problems. And But yeah, that's annoying. So I know that James Wilson is really into his Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, as is Rob Wolf, of course.
Yeah, I want to go up and train with Rob Wolf. I know he's got an amazing gym up in Reno, and I would love to get up there and just pick his brain and teach him some jiu-jitsu and have a nice little exchange that way.
Right. And so I'm thinking with this conversation, what the heck? So I don't know if you're a regular listener to the Rob Wolf podcast. He always talks about how he really struggles to perform at his best when he's not eating carbohydrates, and he really enjoys the neurological, the clear thinking that comes with a high fat ketogenic diet, but his Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu really suffers. And
I want to jump in here. I completely agree with that statement, and that's why I was glued. I think it was maybe two podcasts ago. I forget the name of the guy I got on, but you were picking his brain on the subject, And it was the podcast where you had prefaced it with, sorry for talking about myself and cycling again.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I wanted
people to email you better ways you could ask better questions to keep the podcast going.
Yeah.
And then when I listened to the podcast, I thought, no. This is perfect that you were asking those questions, because that's the same dynamic. I think anybody who competes and goes into a ketogenic diet, that's something you fall in love with, is the cognitive function, the ability. And I have a 1-year-old, so I know what you're going through with the 2-year-old. To be able to mitigate sleep loss while in ketosis, that is crucial. But then at the same time, when I need to go into fifth gear and really put the pedal to the metal, there's something lacking there. And that's kind of what I'm trying to play with now with the carb backloading. So I'm right in the same boat with Rob Wolf. But the difference for me is I don't feel like I can't do well in jujitsu. I feel like I can kill it in jujitsu on a ketogenic diet. Where I feel the loss in power is in maximal effort deadlifting or maximal effort squatting, those kind of things. If I'm going for that single rep, I feel sometimes like just the other day I was deadlifting and I got 495 relatively easy on my way up, and we were looking at 525 and I couldn't budge the bar. And then we went back down to 495 later. I felt like I could have hit 495 for 3 reps. So I easily should be able to do 525 in that situation. And yet there was just no, that maximal energy, which just wasn't there.
I see. I'm just laughing at how much weight that is. Do you know how much weight that is? It's like,
no, that's
like
all,
3 times my body weight at least.
it's all relative though. I'm the weakest guy there. And that's part of the deal. You know, when I fought, I trained with guys that were much better than with me. And now when I powerlift, I'm the weakest guy in the group. And I think that's how it's supposed to be. You don't want to be a big fish in a small pond. And I've certainly gained so much more strength working with these guys that are infinitely stronger than me. There's a 22-year-old who just deadlifted 825 and he weighs 220. I mean, he's a beast of a kid, but you know, you pick up lots of tips and tricks and technical things working with guys like that. And that's definitely helped me out.
What was your life like before the ketogenic diet? Like, what inspired you to try this?
Well, it was after I had retired and, you know, just continue to learn and listen to podcasts and read books on diet and nutrition and things like that. And I was hearing more. I think Ben Greenfield was talking about it on his podcast about doing the ketogenic diet. And I love high fat food. I mean, so it wasn't the end of the world to try to get rid of carbohydrates. You know, I love bacon and I've been into really high quality meats. You know, my dad and I bought our own grass fed cow. We split it 50-50 from Oregon. So it's 100% grass fed, grass finished. And we eat really high quality meats and fats and things like that. And it was easier just to increase the fats and cut the carbs and get into this. And then when I got into it, it was like, wow, I feel my brain working for the first time. Mm. I felt like I should go back to school like Rodney Dangerfield and try to retake all my college courses. And I just felt like my brain was working in a way that it hadn't before. And in addition to that, the inflammation, I mean, my systemic inflammation dropped. Knee pain that I had for years was gone. For decades, this knee pain was just lingering in the background and it had vanished. Not to mention, my flexibility went up seamlessly overnight. Like I could just drop first thing in the morning, palms to the ground and touch the ground and, no pain there, no tightness, you know, just everything kind of opened up. And also that baseline endurance just goes through the roof. So there was a lot to it, you know, especially not competing and fighting, which definitely needs a lot of that glycolytic hard as you can go type system. I wasn't using that as much anymore, you know, and even in jujitsu, most of it's flowing and really trying not to exert 100% effort, but just to find, you know, gaps in my opponents and things like that, and then attack. But I feel like the transition into a ketogenic diet has fit perfectly for this time in my life. And especially with having a newborn and now a 1-year-old, it definitely helps.
You find that you have a reduced requirement for sleep.
I feel like I need sleep no matter what, but I also work weekends. You know, I've had shift work as a bartender and bouncer on Saturdays and Sundays for probably the last 7 years. And I'll get home at 3:30 a.m. And with the little guy, you're up at 6:30 or 7:30 no matter what. So even though I can take a nap with them and things like that, I felt a huge difference because I've, you know, after he was born, maybe somewhere between 2 and 3 months old, I started going back to carbs and really trying to push the weight. And I didn't put my finger on it until I was listening to Dr. Dominic DiAgostino on Tim Ferriss's podcast talking about the sleep mitigation and how it helps so much with that and some of these pathways that it's working on in the brain are not yet well understood, you know, including how it affects epilepsy and things like that, and the way that it works in those regards, but it does work. And so right then I was like, oh man, all right, yeah, let me get back on the horse. So when I went back into strict ketosis, the difference was night and day. And that really showed me there, you know, because he was still getting up two or three times a night and then up for good at 6:30 a.m. And that's really been one of the biggest benefits for me as a new parent, is being able to stay in ketosis and load up on the MCTs before bed as well has helped a lot.
Oh, wow. That's really interesting. I just did an interview with Kirk Parsley, and this is not the one that was on my podcast. Kirk was on my podcast a couple of weeks ago. I'm just recording the interviews for a keto summit. It's an online summit that people will be able to get access to very shortly. And Kirk was the first of the interviews for that.
And this is the Navy SEAL doctor who's...
Exactly. So Kirk is a former Navy SEAL and doctor to the Navy SEALs. He's actually Peter Attia's doctor. Do you know who Peter Attia is?
Yes.
Yeah, he's his doctor and Peter is his doctor. And so obviously we talked about sleep for the keto summit. And he talked about how most of the studies that have been done on how much sleep people need, right? So they put them in a darkened room and for 14 hours a day, and they just get as much sleep as they possibly could ever need. And then eventually they settle down to this kind of baseline. And at that point, you realize that the person has, you know, they've just reached how much the basal level of sleep that they need every day. And nobody's ever done studies like that in people who are keto adapted. So we don't know that recommendation of 8 hours a night is how much sleep you need. That's all in non-keto adapted people, which could be very different. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, personally, I've not found that it's reduced my requirement for sleep, but you're right. Like my sleep in theory should be freaking terrible, right? Because I have a 2-year-old and yet I'm certainly not tired during the day, and I don't feel like I have a problem with sleep like I did in the past. So maybe it's the ketosis that's saving me from trouble that I just never would have known otherwise.
Yeah, I think it was night and day being able to see that difference, you know, being in ketosis when my child was born all the way through his first 2 months and then coming out of it for a couple months and then going back into it really just showed me the difference there. Yeah. You know, that's something I really can't wait to, now I got to sign up for this keto summit so I can get all this new information on these studies coming out.
Yeah. I'm so excited about this at the moment. I've got Ben Greenfield, Mark Sisson, Jimmy Moore, Dave Asprey, Rob Wolf, Tim Noakes, Travis Christofferson. I interviewed this morning, was amazing. Talked about cancer. Dominic D'Agostino, obviously, Richard Feynman, Patrick Arnold, Mike T. Nelson, Phil Maffetone, Brian Walsh, Kirk Parsley, I've done, Eric Westman, Jason Fung is tomorrow, Tom Seafried, very excited about that, Chris Master John, Kate Shanahan, Barry Murray, Menno Henselmans is a keto bodybuilder guy, Ken Ford, Ivor Cummings, Catherine Crofts, Max Lagerve, I think he pronounced that, Kieran Clark is a professor of biochemistry from Oxford University in the UK, Alessandro Ferretti, Ron Rosedale, Marty Kendall, Adrian Schleck, maybe, and of course my own Dr. Tommy Woods. So yeah, it's going to be quite a lot of work to get that done, but I'm just going to have so much information at the end of it, I won't know what to do with it. It's going to be phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, I think I caught like the first 90% of the names halfway through, and then the last 50% of the names, guys I'd never heard of, but that's just equally exciting because now I get introduced to new people that I can draw from.
Yeah, so the way that we got this list, I mean, there's definitely some people out there who are very good that I haven't invited, or maybe they were invited and they didn't have time or whatever. But so Tommy, obviously he's deeply involved in research and this whole world. And he just went through, he created a spreadsheet and he's like, this guy's really good. This guy's really good. This guy's really good. Like, you need to go get him. And so, and I mean, we collaborated on it, but it's mostly the people that Tommy thought had the best information based on his technical knowledge. So yeah, they're all really good. But yeah, tell me about some of the work that you've been doing with Grace Liu. So that kind of, you know, I think of Grace Liu as being one of the world's foremost experts on the gut and the gut microbiome. And I think she's looking at the gut in a way that maybe nobody else can. You know, she's looking at the... So what Grace had me do was she took the Ubiome app, which doesn't really tell you much about the data that they've sampled, and she had me write an application on top of that that extracts the data from Ubiome and produces what's called a phylogenetic tree in a PDF diagram. And that allowed Grace to actually look at the species level data from the sample that was taken from the gut. And I'm pretty sure that nobody else on the planet can do what she does with those results. And so, you know, I know you've been working with her, so that makes me instantly question, have you been having trouble with your gut, or how did you come to meet Grace Liu and work with her?
Let's see here. Where did it start? I think I heard her on Dave Asprey's podcast or something like that, and I started following her blog on Animal Farm and was just instantly glued to it. And then I was learning about resistant starch. She was writing a lot about the RS2 and RS3 and the differences. And my wife and I, she was pregnant at the time, and we dove straight in. I came home with like 6 packages of the Bob's Red Mill.
Oh no, you can't say that in front of Grace. She'll club you to death.
No, Grace recommended it. This is before.
Oh, before.
So this is how a relationship started. Of course, I'm following the blog, and she's talking about all the benefits of potato starch that had come from the studies on rats. And so we dive right in, and we're taking it every day. And my wife is getting fatter at a pretty quick rate. And I am getting run down and sick more often than I ever do. And I wasn't sure why. I couldn't put my finger on it, you know. And at some point, I think we had traveled out to Las Vegas to see Natasha's sister and her family. And I was feeling a little run down, so I wanted to double up on the probiotics and this wonderful resistant starch, potato starch. So I added a ton of potato starch to the shake, and I had it before bed. And when I woke up, I could barely breathe out of my nose. I mean, I felt just terrible. So I went back online, and then the new data had come out that said, oh, it turns out that humans' microbiome is a lot different, not being scavengers like rats are. And this rodent model doesn't quite apply to us. And so I immediately wrote her online. I was like, hey, we've been doing this for like 3 months now. My wife has gained a lot of fat. And obviously it showed in this latest research how it destroyed a lot of the good bacteria that helped with metabolism and fat burning and body weight regulation. And as well, a lot of the good bacteria in our gut that helps with immune function. So there you had it. She was gaining weight and my immune system was trash. And I wrote her, I was like, hey, we've been following this for 3 months. What's the fastest way we can try to mitigate the damage and reverse this? And she was like, I'm so sorry. You know, this was new information. This is what's going on now. And really, she's just been amazing. You know, she's helped us tremendously. She switched us over to her bionic fiber with the psyllium, acacia, and inulin foss. And now that she's making her own custom probiotics, we're taking those, the Bifidomax, and we're seeing great results. You know, Natasha's in the best shape of her life with, you know, 1 year post-pregnancy, and I feel great. My immune system's great. Everything's working well. So I really feel a difference, you know, now. And that's kind of was the start of our relationship together, was this one recommendation gone wrong, and then her jumping in at first to correct it and help us out.
I think she's amazing, you know, to actually, you know, stand up and say that, you know, what I said before was wrong and there may be a better solution, because that's not normally the way that things go down, right? Like people... You know, there's the Max Planck quote, or maybe it's not a Max Planck misquote, which is science progresses one funeral at a time, right? Whereas people, you know, they just refuse to change their mind and they just die with this stuff and then things change. And it seems extremely honorable to me that Grace just said, oh, okay, yeah, no, that was wrong. Sorry, you know, if you live on the bleeding edge, you're going to get cut.
Yeah, yeah. And I have no problem with that at all, because it's like, hey, I'm trying to be on the cusp. I know this is new science. I'm working hard to, and it's all N=1. You know, that's really what it boils down to. Well, the people who ask me constantly about this ketogenic diet and everything like that, there is a template to follow, and then the other 90% is fine tuning. You know, and that's why we do the blood testing with the ketone strips and everything like that, because this is how you're going to figure out what works best for you and where you feel your best and how to get into that position. You know, it's not a one size fits all for anything in life.
Absolutely, yeah. You are your own expert. I'm a big fan of that. None of this holding your test results real close to your chest, please, doctor. I want to know what's going on. But that's fantastic. Okay, so those are the fibers that have been working really well for you. And then the ketogenic diet, it can just mean so many things, right? You could have somebody that's eating nothing but meat and fat, or you could have something that's more like our ketogenic diet, which is mostly plant-based, honestly. When you look at our plate, it's mostly plants make up the volume. So is that true for you? Are you getting most of your fiber from the vegetables that you eat?
Yeah, you know, there's a couple of things that I really like. Fast meals and meals you can make and forget about. So we use the crock pot at least 2 or 3 days a week. And that's an easy way to just get a ton of cruciferous veggies in you, which are mainly ketogenic, in my opinion. You know, I'll do a crock pot with a little bone broth, pick a cruciferous vegetable like cauliflower or cabbage, lay that on the bottom, put whatever meat I want on top. Yesterday we did ginger, 2 yellow onions, 3 pounds of organic chicken thighs, and then 3 cans of coconut cream and some tikka masala Indian curry paste. And that was amazing and very low carb, high fat, but just loaded with high fiber as well. I think onion has quite a bit of inulin or good prebiotic fiber.
Oh yeah, that's a good one.
From what I was reading. And then that's a good way. They talk about how the outer shell of onions has the most amount of quercetin. But if you've ever tried to eat the outer shell of an onion, it can be quite a task.
But, you can do it. You're a tough guy.
Yeah. Crock pot it for 16 hours on low heat, and it's actually edible. So I think that's an easy way to get these good things in our body.
Oh, interesting.
And then the other way is just making a nice big salad. But this is something that I found fascinating in listening to you talk about the organic acids test was how our body breaks down oxalates. And I've heard both sides of the coin, you know, oh, Dave Asprey saying you should always cook your kale and steam it and remove some of the oxalic acid. And then other people saying, no, eat it raw. Some of these tiny little things that that kale and some of these other vegetables cause problematically end up having a full swing effect from the way our body responds to them. You know, how our body ramps up to mitigate some of the small amount of damage actually has an end result that's better. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of this?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not sure what to make of it. So I'm not sure.
Neither am I. So we do it both. But that's why I have cooked veggies, cooked cruciferous, and then I'll do some raw kale and raw spinach. But I'm glued to the. I can't get this test back fast enough.
I hate
enough.
It. Like the mass spectrometry, it takes a couple of weeks. Yeah, it's annoying. So we're seeing. I can tell you what we've been seeing since that interview. It's with Dr. Bill Shaw, and I'll link to this in the show notes. And the Great Plains organic acids, it kind of brought new insight to what was going on inside people's guts specifically. And the oxalates we'd never measured before on the Great Plains test. And so we just didn't know what was going on. And, you know, we'd heard people like Dave Asprey talk about this compound before, but not really thought about it too much. And then sure enough, you know, you start doing the test and it's coming back high on everyone. And sure enough, the research checks out and Bill Shaw's a great guy and he does his homework and what he says is valid. And the question is the oxalate coming from the person's diet or is it coming from something else that's in the gut? Because every time we see the oxalic acids, we also see massive overgrowth of yeast and fungus, and we know there's a strong connection there. So it could be that all these people have been driving themselves potty, you know, trying to avoid the oxalates in foods, which is almost impossible. And really what's going on is a yeast overgrowth in the gut. And so that's what they really need to deal with is the yeast and not the oxalates. And I think it makes sense, you know, don't, you know, go buy 10 pounds of spinach and then blend it up with an avocado and drink it every morning. That's probably not the best thing to do. But at the same time, it's probably nothing to do with the amount of vegetables you eat. That's my bet. We'll see what happens, what pans out with that.
Yeah, I'm definitely into that. And I've had to run a Candida cleanse a couple of times, so it wouldn't surprise me if that was the case. But yeah, when I listened to this, that was another thing. When I found out about the organic acids test, why didn't I know about this 5 years ago? Why didn't I know about this 10 years ago? What an amazing thing to figure out so much about the body. You know, if you have bacterial overgrowth or fungus problems, kind of where your neurotransmitter depletion is, or if it's lopsided, a lot of people lie in bed awake at night and they can't turn off their brain. Some people are tired all day long, and it may not necessarily be adrenal fatigue. It might just have to do with neurotransmitters and which side you're lopsided towards.
Absolutely. And Tommy talked about this. I should link to this in the podcast notes as well. On the Endurance Planet podcast, he did a really good interview with Tawny, where they talked about women's hormones and PMS and how they relate to neurotransmitters. And we know that we can measure the neurotransmitters on the organic acids, right? So if you're a woman with PMS, you do an organic acids test whilst you've got the symptoms, and then we can look to see what's going on with serotonin and dopamine and all of that. And all of a sudden it's like, you know, just rather than guessing with a bunch of herbs, you're actually doing something a lot more diagnostic. And that typically, I think, leads to better results. So it's an exciting time that some of these tests are becoming commercially available.
Yeah, a lot of people, and even in Dave Asprey's Better Baby book with his wife, Lana Asprey, they talked about how the child will take whatever it needs. And that can be very depleting for a mother, especially if you have back-to-back children and you don't do child spacing. I think Natasha, my wife, has had, you know, a rougher go of it simply, you know, because of these things. And she's just submitted her organic acids test as well. So I'll be very interested to see exactly what's going on in there and, you know, what corrections can be made. That's another great thing about it is just, it's not just, hey, here's what's wrong with you. It's here's what's wrong with you. And now here's how we fix it. And that's an incredible, empowering thing that we can have at our disposal.
So I think that's one of the reasons the doctors don't run this test. It's not really about treating and diagnosing disease. It's about creating performance and longevity. And they don't really have a way to bill for that, right? So If your goal is just to be a better UFC fighter or a better mountain biker, I can't bill for that. So maybe I'm not so interested in the organic acids for that reason. And yeah, I have to say though, it does tend to lead to a crap ton of supplements. So because it measures so much stuff, it's going to find problems. And the temptation is to try and fix them all. And so if you're someone like me, like I just want to do everything at once. And so now I'm taking carnitine. I'm taking a lot of supplements. I won't bore you with the whole list, but it's quite a lot of stuff.
Yeah, but I could probably go down the list with you and take them all. I've been on acetyl-L-carnitine for a while. I actually went and got N-acetylcysteine after listening to that podcast, just because I was like, you know what? I can never have too much glutathione. So let me get this going right now, regardless of what my scores come back at. And my wife and I have been supplementing with that. It's cheap, you know, I mean, all these things add up, but if it's cheap and you can just toss it into the mix and not worry about it, then I don't see any issue with that.
And then what's happening with your kids? So the one-year-old, are they starting to, is it a boy or a girl?
It's a boy. His name is Bear.
Oh, that's cool. And is he starting to show an interest in food?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He, you know, what's funny is he eats whatever we eat, and he's really into some of the spicier food. I mean, there was, I think the first time he had curry with us, it was like a green curry, and it had a decent amount of chilies in it. It was making me sweat. And my wife was like, hey, he shouldn't have this, you know. My cousin's a doctor, and they have a little girl who's maybe 4 months older, and they're like, oh no, it's good to let them try different things. And if they like it, they like it, but just expose them to different things. And so right then hey, we got the green light. So I gave him some of this green curry, and he absolutely loved it. I mean, he was literally flexing with excitement every time he'd have a bite. He'd go, ah, you know, his whole body would light up. And we've tried every different type of curry. You know, Indian curries, Thai curries, and he loves them all. So he likes the spicier food. He likes a lot of the broths and the coconut cream, stewed meats, you know, chicken and beef and things like that. Sometimes we'll bird feed him where we chew it up and hand it over to him. But he does really well with that. And he's a savory guy. I think I'm not trying to make him ketogenic. You know, he likes some sweets, but for the most part, he really does like these heavier, fattier, salty foods. And I'm okay with that too, you know?
I'm okay with it too. And I'm just wondering, you know, so much of what children eat is learned from their parents, I'm sure. And so our daughter is now 2.5, and she just wants to eat what she sees me eating, particularly at lunchtime. I have kind of the big ass salad that you talked about at lunchtime, and that's what she wants to eat. You know, a bunch of leaves with a can of sardines and half an avocado in it. And she loves that stuff. But I just kind of worry, you know, I think of kids maybe needing, so there's a problem definitely with just weaning kids, I think, straight on to just pure carbohydrates, rice crackers and all that crap, but there's zero micronutrition, it's just a bunch of carbs. But at the same time, I don't really want her to be, I'm still not convinced that ketosis is a really good idea for certain groups of people or in the long term. And I'm worried that Ivy's just going to end up gravitating to not liking carbs just because we don't eat them that much. But what are you finding with your boy? Does he still eat some carbs?
Well, yes, he does. And I had listened to Dominic D'Agostino when he was talking about, I think he wrote an article for Rob Wolf. It was a four-piece series on Rob Wolf's website that talked about the history of the ketogenic diet. And one of the things that, you know, obviously in the 1920s, it was developed for kids with drug-resistant epilepsy. What they found was all those kids survived and they did well, but a lot of them were smaller without carbohydrates. So I think there's something when you're growing at that rate, and that's, you know, if you look at mother's milk is not just fat and protein. There's about an equal amount of carbohydrate in there as well. And I think that kids need all of those things when they're growing at that pace. So we find different ways to kind of make it savory to get them as carbs, but I'll put in a baked sweet potato and I'll mash that up with a little coconut cream. And he likes that a little bit better than just a straight sweet potato. Or I'll do bananas, but I'll fry them on medium heat with some grass-fed butter and put a little cinnamon on top of that. And then you'll have the mashed banana with butter and cinnamon. And he seems to enjoy that more than just straight banana or, you know, these mango banana kids pockets things that you can get in the stores. So I try to add fat or a little bit of collagen powder to any of his fruity things. And he definitely enjoys that more.
That's really awesome. Yeah, our daughter, her main thing she likes is fruit, right? So it's May in California and the farmer's market is starting to have lots of delicious fruit. And we had some blackberries this week that I have never tasted anything like them. They're like, you know, the size of golf balls and you know, that's little balls of sugar. And we used to have those things grow in our garden when I was a kid, and they, you know, they'd make you kind of wince a little bit like a lemon when you ate them. And these things are maybe my palate has changed a little bit, but I think there's a lot of sugar in those, and she just gobbles those down too. But other than that, she eats the same as us. Julie does eat some carbs. But you know what? I tell you, it's interesting. You talk about breast milk, and this is slightly weird, but we did the test. I took some of the ketone strips and I tested Julie's blood ketones, beta hydroxybutyrate, and they were 0.2 millimole. And Julie doesn't restrict carbohydrates in any way. Like, she's not thinking about it at all. I would say she eats a low carb diet, but she doesn't really think about it. So 0.2, technically it's not nutritional ketosis, but there's obviously some level of ketones there. And then we tested her breast milk. Of course you did. And it was 0.6. So there was actually a significant amount of ketones in the breast milk. So
yeah, that's something Dominic D'Agostino talked about as well, that it's actually quite normal for children to get these ketones in. And that's something that you know, that's why he says it's maybe the fourth macronutrient should be ketones. Look at it that way.
And now what we've got to figure out, and maybe we might have to wait until we have another baby to figure this out, is we know that, and I say Tommy told me, he sent me the papers and I read them. The ketones that appear in breast milk, they're actually synthesized, or specifically, sorry, I should say, not ketones, the MCT, the medium triglycerides that are ketogenic for the baby that appear in breast milk, they come from carbohydrates that are synthesized in the breast tissue. So mum actually needs some carbs to make medium chain triglycerides so that baby can be in ketosis. And so if mum is in ketosis, that might actually be holding something back from the baby. So what we'd really like to do is like some, you know, test, like if Julie eats a high carb diet, what does that do to the breast milk?
Yeah, well, actually, I was going to mention that Natasha, when she'd follow, if she felt like she was getting fat from this potato starch, she'd say, let's cut the carbs. She'd notice that her boob size would kind of drop. And then once we had Bear, if we cut carbs at all, her breast milk would be cut in half. So we found these nice, I would make a coconut rice dish with white rice, coconut cream, and some xylitol to sweeten it. And she'd gobble that up and her breast supply or milk supply would double just overnight.
Oh, wow.
And we ran that same test while she was pregnant. She saw me doing the ketone strips every night. She was like, oh, I wonder where I'm at. And I said, I don't want to waste a $4 strip on you. That's where you're at. I just told you your score, 0.0. She's like, please, let's try. She said 0.9 millimolar. I was like, you got to be kidding me right now. She's having at least 100 grams of carbs a day. But if you think about it, most of those are going towards building little Bear inside her. So she was still in nutritional ketosis, even with eating large amounts of carbohydrates each night.
That's interesting. And whereabouts do you normally sit during the day?
Well, I find that I feel my best when I'm over, you know, between 1.0 and 2.0 millimolar. With the carb backloading and things like that, I'm usually hovering around 0.7, 0.8.
Okay, so that's still technically, I'm actually lower than that, especially first thing in the morning. I'm normally around 0.2, which is technically not ketosis at all, but I feel good. And so that's what I do. And then it's up to about 1.2 in the afternoons. But that's interesting. So tell me how you use the carb backloading strategy. Will you just wait until you've done that deadlifting session and then refill the carbs as appropriate? Or do you plan ahead, or how do you do it?
Well, I really haven't been, you know, I had this 50K race that I was prepping for, and I'm not a distance runner by any means. I think the furthest I'd ever done was a half marathon, maybe a handful of times. And I heard about Dr. Kelly Starr, the Becoming a Supple Leopard Mobility Wad CrossFit guy to San Francisco. He had done a 50K and he weighs 230 pounds. So he was my inspiration for it. And so I remained really ketogenic during that, even though I was still lifting heavy weights and pushing myself in that regard. Once I finished that April 9th, that's when I started playing with carbohydrate backloading and trying to really push my numbers in the strength room. You know, I can't say, and this is kind of what interested me in the podcast you just did, where you were picking the guy's brain on it, was how the muscle fiber changes over time. And I feel like even if I carb backload, I might be missing that extra gear, not because I'm not glycogen loaded, but just because the muscle fiber has changed to more of this fat oxidizing, slow twitch muscle. And so that's kind of where now I'm like, well, I mean, do I make it more consistent? Because if I'm more consistently eating carbohydrates, and Mark Sisson talked about how he's definitely not in nutritional ketosis, but he's still relatively low carb and he has no carbs during the day and he'll carb backload at night. If I went to a diet similar to that, would that change my muscle over time? I'm not sure. So that's something I might play with. But at the same time, with this lack of sleep, there is a craving to be in nutritional ketosis just for the fact that I mentally feel so much better. And that outweighs everything, in my opinion. How I feel, my mood, my quality of life, that outweighs, you know, if I can pick up 600 pounds or if I can only pick up 550.
I was going to say a first world problem, but it's probably just a Kyle Kingsbury problem. not many other people. But what on earth persuaded you to do a 50K run then, when you've got, so I've, you know, interviewed all these experts and I've tried to unpick or put together the puzzle that is optimum health and performance. And it seems to me like walking a lot and then occasionally lifting heavy things is a really good strategy for health and most types of performance. So I'm sure that you know that and you're already doing those things. So what on earth persuades you to want to do a 50K run?
Yeah, you're exactly right. And the more studies they show now, the more we realize that, hey, a marathon and above is not healthy. You know, regardless of what people tell you, it's not a healthy thing. And you can even see in people that do chronic endurance events, the enlarged portion of the heart just from having to pump the volumes, and that can be an issue. But it wasn't about health. It was just about, can I push myself to do something that may not necessarily be good at, you know, and really grind through it and then know in the end, like, yeah, I can run a 50K. And that's really what the challenge was for me. We went with a group called Ultra Adventures, and they kind of go through – they do an event at Grand Canyon, I think we're going to do next year. They do an event in Zion, Utah, which we did this year in April. And they, you know, they just go to these beautiful, majestic places. You're balls deep in nature, you know, and that's really what it's about, is just this amazing experience at the same time that you're putting your body through the grinder. And more than the race itself was knowing, hey, if I have this date where I'm going to have to run 50K, I know I need to prep for it. And really that was kind of my, all right, now that I can know that I got to put the road work in, but not, you know, ridiculous miles. Obviously you read Primal Endurance and Ben Greenfield's book and different things like that. You know that you can get away with doing high intensity intervals and really only putting in one slow, easy snail's pace jog a week will get you there. And I did just fine with that. I didn't have a record time or anything like that, but my goal was just to finish under the 10-hour cutoff. And I did. I finished in 9 hours and 56 minutes.
Oh,
so
wow.
I was the last guy to cross before the cutoff. 26 people came in after me, so I wasn't dead last. You know, we had some pretty amazing race conditions. They had a storm come in the day before, and they almost canceled the race because I don't know if you're familiar with the terrain in Zion, but it's pretty fine powder, okay, and it can be a little dusty. But when it rains, it turns into straight clay. And I don't know if you've ever done any rehab on like a slide board where you kind of slide back and forth with these funny socks on your shoes.
No, I never have.
It opens up the adductors. It's like what a speed skater would do. Well, this was kind of like that clay. I would say 80% of the run was really a hike through this slide board clay where I was almost doing the splits, you know, and people were eating dirt left and right. I fell in the mud several times. It was, It was like a 10-hour tough mudder. I mean, it was pretty brutal. Not a whole lot of it was running, you know, maybe 20% of it I was actually running, but you know, it was an amazing thing. And it's not something I'm gonna make a habit of. I might do this one next year in the Grand Canyon just to know what it's like to be able to run the whole race instead of having to hike a lot of it through mud. But it was more for the challenge than anything else. You know, I think it's important that we continue to do things that stretch our limits and push us to places where we don't feel comfortable.
Well, you're certainly doing that. That's a solid mountain bike ride. 50K, 30 miles. That's like a solid mountain bike ride for me. You know, that would take me 3 hours, 4 hours on the bike, right? So to do it on foot is kind of difficult for me to get my head around. What did you eat during that time? How did you fuel? You're kind of limited when you're on foot, right? You can't really carry that much food. I feel like it's easier on the bike to carry calories.
Well, you know, I had a fanny pack. I'm big on wearing a fanny pack, so.
Oh, I saw that on the Joe Rogan podcast. I enjoyed that.
I think you guys call them,
yeah.
Okay, you guys call them bum bags because fanny means something else, right?
I've got my daughter. I use this chamois cream. I've got this non-toxic chamois cream, we call it in the UK, and she calls it fanny cream, which I find hilarious. She loves to get hold of it and smear it all over her face and everything. It's great. But bum bag, yeah, so you carry your calories in a bum bag.
Yeah, I got this book, Feed Zone Portables, that Dr. Kelly Starr sent it to me. And basically what I made was like this baked egg dish mixed with steamed white rice, avocado, cacao, and xylitol. So it had a little bit of sweetness, some sea salt. I had my protein, it was high fat, and then there was still a little bit of complex carbohydrate in there as well. That was my fuel. I made like cupcakes. I put them in the cupcake pans and baked them the night before, and they were pretty delicious. And it actually turned out to be great because there was supposed to be 4 aid stations in this race, and it ended up only being 1 due to the race conditions. So thankfully, I was well hydrated. Being in ketosis, I could get away with having a little less fluid intake. I think that was the biggest mistake I made, was thinking I'd have these 4 aid stations and to not bring water on me.
Right.
Whereas everyone else had their camelbacks and all that. Mm-hmm. And so they could have a sip of water whenever they needed. Yeah, that was pretty much it. But as far as the food was concerned, I was good to go there. And then I had some keto canna in these two little packs that I had. So once I did make it to the aid station, I could fill up the water in there, shake up the keto canna, and get some automatic beta hydroxybutyrate salt and calcium loaded into me.
Interesting. Wow. You know, all the tips and tricks, like you're doing it all. I do know those Feed Zone portables. So I ride with a local guy here and I'm really hoping to get him onto the podcast. I know he's very busy. It just so happens like there's two people that ride bikes in Bonnie Doon and he's the other one. And he's working on an HIV vaccine. He was a biotech guy that just quit his job and is doing a PhD and he's working on a vaccine.
Do they inject you with HIV to get rid of the HIV? Is that process behind it?
I don't want to go too deep into this because I don't really understand it, but it's really a really, really difficult area, but they've obviously made a ton of progress with it. And so I'm hoping to have him on. But yeah, that was the flimsy segue there, was we've done some really long rides together recently, you know, like between 4 and 5 hours. And he's really into those Feed Zone portables and the baked eggs. And I have to say, yeah, it did look pretty good. But I've got to this place now where I can do rides like that and not eat anything at all. And I feel like I do really well on that. You know, like my gut, I don't like putting food in my gut while I'm exercising if I can avoid it. And I'll do it in a race, but just for a normal training ride, I don't really feel the need to do that. But
yeah, I completely agree with you on that. I don't eat anything in a half marathon. I mean, if it's shorter and it's not too demanding, there's really no reason. All you need to do is stay hydrated, especially in a ketogenic state, because you have all this fuel on tap for your body. Mm-hmm. But that 10 hours was pretty damn grueling for me. I'm not used to running that far. So the Feed Zone portables definitely came in handy for me.
And then so everything you've learned, you've obviously learned a ton since you retired. Do you ever get a chance to reconnect with some of your former colleagues, you know, in the fighting world? And are you able to coach them or teach them or pass on anything you've learned? Or
yeah, I do. You know, I keep in contact with all the guys from The Ultimate Fighter, Ryan Bader and Tom Lawler, Vinnie Magalish, a lot of these guys that are still fighting and top tier guys, you know, ranked in the top 10. The guys in my backyard at AKA, they're doing big things. A lot of them are gearing up for title defenses and things like that. So I get in their ear and talk with them about the latest things. And, you know, it's really just who's receptive. You know, if you've made a lot of it, if you've made it that far and you've become the champ, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And a lot of them have that kind of mindset. You know, they're not necessarily looking for the next big thing or different ways to monitor and watch exactly, you know, what's coming out of their body to see how they can make small changes that'll create big improvements down the road. And then other guys, you know, they're just constantly glued to anything. And I send a few of my fighter friends, we just bounce podcasts off each other. Like, dude, did you hear Sis on a Rogue? I'm like, oh no, I'll listen to it, you know, and then I'm like, hey, check this guy out. And I got a lot of people into your podcast as well, simply by getting the reference from Dr. Grace Liu. She's like, hey, you want to listen to this one on organic acids test? And you want to listen to this? And I was like, oh man, it's just blew my mind. So yeah, we're in a wonderful, wonderful time in the world where we can share this information. And it's just so many good things are coming out of it. People are just publishing this stuff and it's going out there. And, you know, everyone has an excuse on, oh, I don't have time to read this book. That's all fine. But you have time in your car to put on a podcast and listen to this information. Nobody can turn that down.
Yeah, no, I love my podcast. I still listen to tons and tons of podcasts. And you're right, we do live in this incredible time where it's so disruptive and the information travels so fast. And this came up in my interview for the Keto Summit with Travis this morning. You know, you look at some of these solutions, they've been around since the 1920s. And then some other important studies that were done in cancer in the 1980s. And, you know, why didn't that information propagate as quickly as it should? Well, it was all buried in a library somewhere. You know, it was in somebody's freaking filing box somewhere where it never could be found with a Google search. And now you can figure stuff out. I mean, so Tommy, we call him the PubMed Pro. He's just unbelievable. Like, you ask him a question. So what's the mechanism of this, Tommy? Like, how does phosphatidylserine lower cortisol? And he'll come back with you within 30 seconds with seven really good human studies that have been done that precisely explain the mechanism. And we just live in this time where, you know, that's easy for him especially, but that just never would have been possible. You know, he would have had to spend 2 weeks in the library trying to figure that thing out. And he might have turned up empty handed at the end of it. So, yeah, it's pretty incredible the age in which we live. We've got crappy food that is all, you know, like food science. You can go to hell, like you've not really done anything good for us. But
but we're gonna feed starving kids in Africa, right? We're gonna end world hunger with this glyphosate ridden nastiness.
Yeah, it's true. I have to keep that in mind that you know, a lot of what we talk about is slightly elitist, right? Especially the supplements are rather elitist. They're so expensive.
Well, I think that, you know, like I said, I think that's one of the beautiful things about the oats test and different things like that, and especially the Ubiome test. I mean, $90, that's when you talk about what it can do for you and all the things that the microbiome influences and how we feel, our mood, and just general quality of life. There's no reason people shouldn't be doing a stool sample for $90, yeah, at least twice a year. Mm-hmm. You know, that's something that's easily correctable. And really, it's just, I'm always reminded, Paul Check has a quote that I absolutely love. Sooner or later, your health will be your number one concern.
Right. Yeah. It's
and true. You can put all your eggs in one bed. You can do whatever you want to do. But, you know, whether you're lying on your deathbed and that's when it becomes your number one concern, or whether you make it a priority right now, you know, you'll always have the resources to make changes and to learn and to gravitate and make small changes over time if that's your priority. And that's really what it just boils down to, is making it your priority.
No, absolutely. It's certainly my priority. I think I probably overthink it now. It's all I talk about, all I think about. I'm so excited about it all. And Julie and I talk about it probably too much as well. I don't know. Ivy's probably going to be really, really turned off by it, isn't she? My daughter will just like hate all of it and just want to be a rebel, I bet you. That's my worst fear, but I bet it's going to happen. So is there anything else? I mean, you're not really kind of a... Are you a coach, or is there anything, I mean, you're not an author. It's like, is there anything that people should know about you, or is there a place where people can go to find out more about what you've learned?
Yeah, you know, I mean, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at KingsBoo. That's KingsBoo. We'll be starting a podcast here called The Mom's Garage Podcast, but it's been put on hold because we live in my mom's garage and it's not necessarily the best place with construction going on right by us to do a podcast. But yeah, that's about it. There's no book yet. There's nothing like that. I'm really just trying to learn more myself and experiment and really fine tune. And I do coach some people here in the Bay Area if you're local, but you know, that's not really my thing. I think my thing now is focused on making sure that I provide the best situation for my son. I'd like to start a gym here soon out in Vegas. On mixed martial arts, jiu-jitsu, and meditation, and diet, nutrition, and all the things that I've really focused on. And that's about it. Just continue to learn and grow.
Yeah, no, well, I'll have to talk about that. Send me the link once you get the podcast going, and then people can check that out once it's going.
Most definitely, Chris.
Well, this has been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Kyle.
Thank you so much. We'll have to have me back on once I finish this oats test and start making changes.
Oh, yeah, we can talk about your organic acids result. That would be fun, actually. I think people probably would enjoy that.
Yeah, I'm pumped. Maybe that'll give me up to that 600-pound deadlift I'm chasing.
Yeah, maybe. We'll see.
All righty, Chris. Thank you so much for having me.
Cheers, then.